Chapter 10. To force upwards the ponderous iron bar, I might as well have tried to lift the cathedral itself. Down, down, down it came, closer and yet closer. I screamed to Pompey for aid, but he said that I had hurt his feelings by calling him an ignorant old squint-eye. I yelled to Diana, but she only said bow wow wow, apostrophe, and that I had told her on no account to stir from the corner. Apostrophe, apostrophe, thus I had no relief to expect from my associates. Meantime the ponderous and terrific scythe of time, for I now discovered the literal import of that classical phrase, had not stopped, nor was it likely to stop, in its career. Down and still down, it came. It had already buried its sharp edge a full inch in my flesh, and my sensations grew indistinct and confused. At one time I fancied myself in Philadelphia with the stately Dr. Moneypenny, at another in the back parlor of Mr. Blackwood receiving his invaluable instructions. And then again the sweet recollection of better and earlier times came over me, and I thought of that happy period when the world was not all a desert, and Pompey not altogether cruel. The ticking of the machinery amused me. Amused me, I say, for my sensations now be ordered upon perfect happiness, and the most trifling circumstances afforded me pleasure. The eternal click-clack, click-clack, click-clack of the clock was the most melodious of music in my ears, and occasionally even put me in mind of the graceful sermonic harangues of Dr. Ollapod. Then there were the great figures upon the dial plate, how intelligent, how intellectual they all looked. And presently they took to dancing the mazurka, and I think it was the figure 5, who performed the most to my satisfaction. She was evidently a lady of breeding. None of your swaggerers, and nothing at all indelicate in her motions. She did the pirouette to admiration, whirling round upon her apex. I made an endeavor to hand her a chair, for I saw that she appeared fatigued with her exertions, and it was not until then that I fully perceived my lamentable situation. Lamentable indeed. The bar had buried itself 2 inches in my neck. I was aroused to a sense of exquisite pain. I prayed for death, and, in the agony of the moment, could not help repeating those exquisite verses of the poet Miguel de Cervantes. Vanny Buren, tan escondida, query noti senti veni, pork and pleasure, deli mori, nami, torni, dairy, witty. But now a new horror presented itself, and one indeed sufficient to startle the strongest nerves. My eyes, from the cruel pressure of the machine, were absolutely starting from their sockets. While I was thinking how I should possibly manage without them, one actually tumbled out of my head, and, rolling down the steep side of the steeple, lodged in the rain gutter which ran along the eaves of the main building. The loss of the eye was not so much as the insolent air of independence and contempt with which it regarded me after it was out. There it lay in the gutter just under my nose, and the airs it gave itself would have been ridiculous had they not been disgusting. Such a winking and blinking were never before seen. This behavior on the part of my eye in the gutter was not only irritating on account of its manifest insolence and shameful ingratitude, but was also exceedingly inconvenient on account of the sympathy which always exists between two eyes of the same head, however far apart. I was forced, in a manner, to wink and to blink, whether I would or not, in exact concert with the scoundrelly thing that lay just under my nose. I was presently relieved, however, by the dropping out of the other eye. In falling it took the same direction, possibly a concerted plot, as its fellow. Both rolled out of the gutter together, and in truth I was very glad to get rid of them. The bar was now 4 inches, and a half deep in my neck, and there was only a little bit of skin to cut through. My sensations were those of entire happiness, for I felt that in a few minutes, at farthest, I should be relieved from my disagreeable situation. And in this expectation I was not at all deceived. At 5:25 in the afternoon, precisely, the huge minute hand had proceeded sufficiently far on its terrible revolution to to sever the small remainder of my neck. I was not sorry to see the head which had occasioned me so much embarrassment at length make a final separation from my body. It first rolled down the side of the steeple, then lodged, for a few seconds, in the gutter, and then made its way, with a plunge, into the middle of the street. I will candidly confess that my feelings were now of the most singular, nay, of the most mysterious, the most perplexing and incomprehensible character. My senses were here and there at one and the same moment. With my head I imagined, at one time, that I, the head, was the real Signora Psyche Zenobia, at another I felt convinced that myself, the body, was the proper identity. To clear my ideas on this topic I felt in my pocket for my snuff box, but, upon getting it, and endeavoring to apply a pinch of its grateful contents in the ordinary manner, I became immediately aware of my peculiar deficiency, and threw the box at once down to my head. It took a pinch with great satisfaction, and smiled me an acknowledgement in return. Shortly afterward it made me a speech, which I could hear, but indistinctly without ears. I gathered enough, however, to know that it was astonished at my wishing to remain alive under such circumstances. In the concluding sentences it quoted the noble words of Ariosto, Il pover amici non si ricordi, and ave combattentieri morti, thus comparing me to the hero who, in the heat of the combat, not perceiving that he was dead, continued to contest the battle with inextinguishable valor. There was nothing now to prevent my getting down from my elevation, and I did so. What it was that Pompey saw, so very peculiar in my appearance I have never yet been able to find out. The fellow opened his mouth from ear to ear, and shut his two eyes, as if he were endeavoring to crack nuts between the lids. Finally, throwing off his overcoat, he made one spring for the staircase and disappeared. I hurled after the scoundrel these vehement words of Demosthenes, Andrew O'Phlegethon, you really make haste to fly, and then turned to the darling of my heart, to the one-eyed, the shaggy-haired Diana. Alas! What a horrible vision affronted my eyes! Was that a rat I saw skulking into his hole? Are these the picked bones of the little angel who has been cruelly devoured by the monster? Ye gods! And what do I behold, is that the departed spirit, the shade, the ghost, of my beloved puppy, which I perceive sitting with a grace so melancholy, in the corner. Hearken! For she speaks, and, heavens! It is in the German of Schiller, und stubby duck, so stubby dun, duck she, alas! And are not her words too true? And if I died, at least I died, for thee, sweet creature! She too has sacrificed herself in my behalf. Dogless, niggerless, headless, what now remains for the unhappy Signora Psyche Zenobia? Alas, nothing! I have done. Tilde 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 end of text tilde 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 equals 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 mystification slid. If these be your asados and ontents, I'll have none of them. Ned Knowles. The Baron Ritzner von Jung was a noble Hungarian family, every member of which, at least as far back into antiquity as any certain records extend, was more or less remarkable for talent of some description, the majority for that species of grotesquerian conception of which Tieck, a scion of the house, has given a vivid, although by no means the most vivid exemplifications. My acquaintance with Ritzner commenced at the magnificent Chateau Jung, into which a train of droll adventures, not to be made public, threw a place in his regard, and here, with somewhat more difficulty, a partial insight into his mental conformation. In later days this insight grew more clear, as the intimacy which had at first permitted it became more close. And when, after 3 years of the character of the Baron Ritzner von Jung, I remember the buzz of curiosity which his advent excited within the college precincts on the night of the 25th of June. I remember still more distinctly that while he was pronounced by all parties at first sight the most remarkable man in the world, no person made any attempt at accounting for his opinion. that he was unique appeared so undeniable that it was deemed impertinent to inquire wherein the iniquity consisted. But, letting this matter pass for the present, I will merely observe that, from the first moment of his setting foot within the limits of the university, he began to exercise over the habits, manners, persons, purses, and propensities of the whole community which surrounded him, an influence the most extensive and despotic, yet at the same time the most indefinite and altogether unaccountable. Thus the brief period of his residence at the university forms an era in its annals, and is characterized by all classes of people appertaining to it, or its dependencies as, at very extraordinary epoch forming the domination of the Baron Ritzner von Jung, then of no particular age, by which I mean, that it was impossible to form a guess respecting his age by any data personally afforded. He might have been 15 or 50, and was 21 years and 7 months. He was by no means a handsome man, perhaps the reverse. The contour of his face was somewhat angular and harsh. His forehead was lofty and very fair, his nose a snub, his eyes large, heavy, glassy, and meaningless. About the mouth there was more to be observed. The lips were gently protruded, and rested the one upon the other, after such a fashion, that it is impossible to conceive any, even the most complex, combination of human features, conveying so entirely, and so singly, the idea of unmitigated gravity, solemnity and repose. It will be perceived, no doubt, from what I have already said, that the Baron was one of those human anomalies now, and then to be found, who make the science of mystification the study, and the business of their lives. For this science a peculiar turn of mind gave him instinctively the cue, while his physical appearance afforded him unusual facilities for carrying his prospects into effect. I quaintly term the domination of the Baron Ritzner von Jung, ever rightly entered into the mystery which overshadowed his character. I truly think that no person at the university, with the exception of myself, ever suspected him to be capable of a joke, verbal or practical. The old bulldog at the garden gate would sooner have been accused, the ghost of Heraclitus, or the wig of the emeritus professor of theology. This too, when it was evident that the most egregious and unpardonable of all conceivable tricks, whimsicalities, and buffooneries were brought about, if not directly by him, at least plainly through his intermediate agency or connivance. The beauty, if I may so call it, of his art mystifique, lay in that consummate ability resulting from an almost intuitive knowledge of human nature, and a most wonderful self-possession, by means of which he never failed to make it appear that the drolleries he was occupied in bringing to a point arose partly in spite and partly in consequence of the laudable efforts he was making for their prevention and for the preservation of the good order and dignity of Alma Mater. The deep, the poignant, the overwhelming mortification which upon each such failure of his praiseworthy endeavors would suffuse every lineament of his countenance, left not the slightest room for doubt of his sincerity in the bosoms of even his most skeptical companions. The adroitness, too, was no less worthy of observation by which he contrived to shift the sense of the grotesque from the creator to the created, from his own person to the absurdities to which he had given rise. In no instance before that of which I speak, have I known the habitual mystific escape the natural consequence of his manoeuvres and attachment of the ludicrous to his own character and person. Continually enveloped in an atmosphere of whim, my friend appeared to live only for the severities of society, and not even his own household have for a moment associated other ideas than those of the rigid and august with the memory of the Baron Ritzner von Jung. The demon of the Dulce Farniente lay like an incubus upon the university. Nothing, at least, was done beyond eating and drinking and making merry. The apartments of the students were converted into so many pot houses, and there was no pot house of them all more famous or more frequented than that of the Baron. Our carousals here were many, and boisterous, and long, and never unfruitful of events. Upon one occasion we had protracted our sitting until nearly daybreak, and an unusual quantity of wine had been drunk. The company consisted of 7 or 8 individuals besides the Baron and myself. Most of these were young men of wealth, of high connection, of great family pride, and all alive with an exaggerated sense of honor. They abounded in the most ultra-German opinions respecting the duello. To these quixotic notions some recent Parisian publications, backed by 3 or 4 desperate and fatal conversation, during the greater part of the night, had run wild upon the all-engrossing topic of the times. The Baron, who had been unusually silent and abstracted in the earlier portion of the evening, at length seemed to be aroused from his apathy, took a leading part in the discourse, and dwelt upon the benefits, and more especially upon the beauties, of the received code of etiquette in passages of arms with an ardor, an eloquence, an impressiveness, and an affectionateness of manner, which elicited the warmest enthusiasm from his hearers in general, and absolutely staggered even myself, who well knew him to be a tardy ridiculer of those very points for which he contended, and especially, to hold the entire fanfaronade of dueling etiquette in the sovereign contempt which it deserves. Looking around me during a pause in the Baron's discourse, of which my readers may gather some faint idea when I say that it bore resemblance to the fervid, chanting, monotonous, yet musical sermonic manner of Coleridge, I perceived symptoms of even more than the general interest in the countenance of one of the party. This gentleman, whom I shall call Herman, was an original in every respect except, perhaps, in the single particular, that he was a very great fool. He contrived to bear, however, among a particular set at the university, a reputation for deep metaphysical thinking, and, I believe, for some logical talent. As a duelist he had acquired who had fallen at his hands, but they were many. He was a man of courage undoubtedly. But it was upon his minute acquaintance with the etiquette of the duello, and the nicety of his sense of honor, that he most especially prided himself. These things were a hobby which he rode to the death. To Ritzner, ever upon the lookout for the grotesque, his peculiarities had for a long time past afforded food for mystification. Of this, however, I was not aware, although, in the present instance, I saw clearly that something of a whimsical nature was upon the tapis with my friend, and that Herman was its especial object. As the former proceeded in his discourse, or rather monologue, I perceived the excitement of the latter momently increasing. At length he spoke, offering some objection to a point insisted upon by R, and giving his reasons in detail. To these the Baron replied at length, still maintaining his exaggerated tone of sentiment, and concluding, in what I thought very bad taste, with a sarcasm and a sneer. The hobby of Herman now took the bit in his teeth. This I could discern by the studied hair-splitting farrago of his rejoinder. His last words I distinctly remember. Why, your opinions, allow me to say, Baron von Jung, although in the main correct, are, in many nice points, discreditable to yourself, and to the university of which you are a member. In a few respects they are even unworthy of serious refutation. I would say more than this, sir, were it not for the fear of giving you offense. Here the speaker smiled blandly. I would say, sir, that your opinions are not the opinions to be expected from a gentleman. As Herman completed this equivocal sentence, all eyes were turned upon the Baron. He became pale, then excessively red, then, dropping his pocket handkerchief, stooped to recover it, when I caught a glimpse of his countenance, while it could be seen by no one else at the table. It was radiant with the quizzical expression which was its natural character, but which I had never seen it assume except when we were alone together, and when he unbent himself freely. In an instant afterward he stood erect, confronting Herman, and so total an alteration of countenance in so short a period I certainly never saw before. For a moment I even fancied that I had misconceived him, and that he was in sober earnest. He appeared to be stifling with passion, and his face was cadaverously white. For a short time he remained silent, apparently striving to master his emotion. Having it. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.